Welcome to Sip Sip Hooray, the podcast for wine lovers and the wine curious. On the pod today, imagine a job where you get to travel around the world, visiting the most incredible wine regions, eating exotic and gourmet meals, and of course, savoring the world's best wines. A dream, right? Well, that pretty much sums up the life of the world wine guys, Mike DeSimone and Jeff Jensen. The guys also write extensively about wine and their adventures. They've authored 6 books so far, including a comprehensive new guide to white wine. They're also in high demand as public speakers about wine, appearing on The Today Show, Martha Stewart, and a host of other television shows. But you get the feeling that even their work isn't really work because it involves their absolute passion, wine. We are delighted the World Wine Guys are joining us on the podcast today. We are the two Marys who like to eat, drink, and be merry. I'm Mary Babbitt.
I'm Mary Orlin. Is it time to turn to white wine? Wine drinkers are now choosing white wine more than red, and our guests today are the perfect ambassadors for exploring the wide and delicious world of white wine. After all, their motto is, "We uncork your world." Mary Babbitt, they probably should have dedicated their new book, White Wine, the Comprehensive Guide to the 50 Essential Varieties and Styles, to us because we're such big wine lovers, white wine lovers.
We are.
We are so sorry we missed that opportunity to dedicate a book to you, but we're excited to be here chatting with you today.
And if it goes into reprint, we can always change that dedication, ladies.
There you go.
It's never too late. So anyway, you guys are avid travelers. You happen to be talking to us from your home on the Costa Brava in Spain, and where you sip Albarino and Rosado by the beach. Y'all are also foodies, but not the typical snooty ones. In fact, one of your most popular pairings was champagne with a tater tot casserole.
Oh, yeah.
So that's true. It was. God, I forgot about that. You got on the Instagram, huh?
Yes, I have been kind of lurking on that. Yes. In addition to traveling the world in search of their next great glass of wine, Mike DeSimone has been on a running streak, racking up 1,825 days on Duolingo. Maybe now it's been a bit more, but that's 5 years without missing a day. And Mike, does that include the language of wine?
You know, Duolingo, although they do actually have Klingon and High Valyrian among their courses, they do not have a dedicated wine language program yet. But I ought to tweet at them because that's the only way they respond and suggest that one.
There you go. So anyway, one thing I really loved about your book is that besides being all about white wine, is that you recommend bottles that people can find easily no matter where they are. And I really appreciate that. So guys, Mike and Jeff, welcome to Sip Sip Hooray.
Well, thank you so much. And thanks for having us. We are, as you said, in Spain, but we're not on the Costa Brava. We're on the Costa del Sol.
Okay.
So we're a little bit further south, and the sun, it's 7 hours different or 6 hours difference from you guys. And the sun is just going down, getting ready to set. So it's almost wine and tapas time here. So we're glad to be able to talk to you before that happens.
I love it.
I'm glad we can accommodate that schedule because there's nothing more important than wine and tapas time.
Absolutely. I love that. Yeah, we are so happy you joined us today. And it sounds like you live in just the world's most idyllic spot. So I kind of want to know how you wound up there and maybe how your love affair with wine started. Is that too big? Can we go there?
Gosh, I think
those are two separate items.
Let's start with our love affair of wine started.
So you start.
Okay, yeah. I'll start.
That's Jeff.
So
Mike.
This is Jeff. And so when I was in grad school in Chicago, I worked as a waiter. And it turned out that I actually sold more wine than any other waiter. Not because I was on commission, but because I loved wine. Hmm. And in fact, I would downsell a lot of my customers who wanted a bottle of Dom Perignon. And I would say, you know, this Piper Heidsieck is really great and it's about half the price. So I built a reputation as being an honest sommelier, but I wasn't a sommelier at that time because we didn't have the word. So when the manager came to me and he said, Jeff, you sell a lot of wine. We want you to be our wine steward. And I said, great, what does that mean? And he said, well, it means you come in an hour early for every shift and you count the bottles. And when we're low, you order more. I said, gosh, I can do that. That's really, really easy. So I said, how much extra does that pay? And he told me it doesn't pay anything at all. And I said, listen, I'm in grad school. I really can't give up an extra 4 hours of my week to count bottles. So I said, but if you wanted to send me to school to be a sommelier, because that was in Chicago and that was the word we used, sommelier.
Love it.
If you wanted to send me to school to become a sommelier, I would actually love to do that. And they did. So I was one of Chicago's first sommelier. And I really, really enjoyed doing that. And my love of wine just continued to grow. So Mike can tell you how he started, but we can also tell you how we joined forces to write about wine.
Exactly. So I studied journalism at NYU, and all through school, and actually even from an early age, when it came time to drink, when other people were drinking cocktails and beer, I was always a wine lover. Now, I'm not going to say it was super fancy wine. It might have been ice, or it might have been Blue Nun. Fortunately, nobody had a phone on their camera at the time, so we can't be sure. But
those were the classics at the time.
Exactly. So I always started off drinking wine, and you know, I guess I'm that consumer that the wine industry always says they're going to capture. The people who start out drinking like the easy drinking, maybe slightly sweet mass market wines, and then over time trade up. And actually, you know, that's what happened. And I became a more sophisticated wine drinker. At the same time, I did not use my journalism degree for many years. And when I finally decided I want to write, I said, well, I don't want to write about news. I don't want to write about politics. I want to write about wine and kind of, you know, reset my career goals. And at that point, Jeff and I were together. We've been together now for 26 years.
Right.
And we joined forces, his knowledge, his love of wine, my knowledge, my love of wine, and my studies in journalism, and then my marketing background, and we started writing together.
But, how did you guys actually meet?
We met on a charity bike ride. It was a 350-mile bike ride from Boston to New York, and every Sunday we would have training rides, you know, a group of people who were going to do the big ride in 4 days. We would train. So Mike and I met on a training ride, and we still love wine, but we still love our bicycles. So here in the Costa del Sol, we do ride our bicycles. But I want to just pick up on Mike's story. So Mike and I had careers, previous careers, before we had our wine career. So we wanted to do something different. And we said, what can we do as we get older and we want to travel? And we talked about putting together his amazing writing skills and my knowledge of wine. So he said, well, we need to write for a magazine. So who do you want to write for? And I said, oh, that's easy. Gourmet, Bon Appetit, Condé Nast Traveler, and Wine Spectator.
So, wow, you didn't set the bar too high.
Exactly. big goals.
Well, you might as well start with
start at the top.
We started at the top. So basically, Mike is an amazing pitch writer. So, you know, we have this house in Spain. We pitched an article about Malaga sweet wine to Tom Matthews at Wine Spectator. And Tom wrote back, which was amazing.
Within 24 hours.
He wrote back and he said, listen, he goes, I'm interested to know what you guys know about Spain. You live there. But I'm not really interested in sweet wine. What do you know about Rioja? And he said, in fact, when are you going back to Rioja next? And it just so happened that we were flying to our house from New York to Malaga the next day, and we diverted, or we changed our flight to fly up north to go to Rioja. So we told Tom, we're going there tomorrow.
So that's how you get the job.
That's yeah. how we got
When do you want me there? That's when I'm going.
So I said, we're going there tomorrow. And he said, get me the story. There's something happening there, and I just want to know what's happening. So at that time, that's when the Marquez de Riscal had just hired Frank Gehry, and they built this beautiful architectural, gorgeous, gorgeous winery. And
Zaha Hadid did the tasting room for Lopez de Heredia.
Wow.
Yeah.
And Calatrava did Bodegas Isios. You know, he's the same one that did the transport center down by the World Trade Center in New York City. So we went there and we were like, okay, this is the story. The story is amazing wine, traditional wine, modern wine, but also modern architecture. So we had our first article ever in Wine Spectator, an 8-page story that included a picture of the Marquez de Riscal
on the cover.
So we had a cover story. It was our, you know, we were shot out of a cannon as wine writers, because after that article, everyone wanted to meet us. And they're like, hey, you know, you want to visit my winery here? You want to visit my winery there? You want to? So we started writing about wine and traveling as a result of being shot out of the cannon. And we still, to this day, thank Tom Matthews at Wine Spectator. He was the one who gave us our first big chance, if you will. So when we, you know, and our life has just gotten even crazier and better because we do travel, as you said in the intro. But that's how it all started. And we're very lucky and blessed. And we never forget how lucky and also, as my dad used to say, it takes a lot of hard work to get this lucky. But we're really very happy to be where we are. So that's how it started.
Well, that's a great story. And how incredible to start on with a cover story. Man, oh, man. Huh. Yes. Well done. Well, you guys sure
settled it down.
I know you've been writing all sorts of stuff since then, for many publications, and you've written, is it 6 books? Is the white wine book the 7th, or is it the 6th?
White Wine is number 6.
It's the 6th.
Number 6. Wow. Okay. Well, let's go there. Let's talk about white wine. As Mary Orland said, she and I are huge fans of white wine. And I feel like it hasn't always gotten a lot of attention, that red wine, because maybe their red wines tend to be more age-worthy, or it is the, you know, it seems to be a finer glass or something. But I love easy drinking, light white wine. And I find that I turn to white wine more than red just for regular everyday consumption. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think first of all, we're equal opportunity drinkers. You know, we drink white, we drink rosé, we drink red. But, you know, after we wrote Red Wine, which was very successful, and that was written with Sterling Epicure, which is a division of Barnes & Noble, that book was super successful. We won an award that, you know, we won Gourmand International Best Wine Book in the World. The year after it came out.
Wow.
And so, which was very exciting. And even so, our publisher did not want to do white wine. They said, mm-hmm. you know, serious wine drinkers and people who read about wine only want to know about red wine. That's the serious, you know, wine that people want to talk about.
We found that a little bit misogynist, because what our publisher was saying, and she was a woman publisher, what she was saying was men, you know, drink mm-hmm. red wine and that's serious, and women drink white wine and that's not serious. And we continue to fight and say, we're going to do this book. We're going to do it with you or without you. And we were really adamant because, you know, white wine is what people are drinking now. And men are drinking white wine. Women are drinking white wine.
Everybody's drinking white
so
wine.
So our publisher was just a little bit prejudiced against women, unfortunately. But I'm going to tell you, you know, we travel, travel the world. And I see a lot more men drinking white wine than red wine these days. So But Mike finished a story about how we fought with our publisher.
So what happened was actually the fortunate thing is that the editor that we worked with, because we worked with different editors actually on each of our four books with Sterling, our final editor moved on. He was at W.W. Norton, where he still is. And James called us and said, "Hey guys, did you ever do anything with that White Wine book that we talked about?" And we said, "No, we didn't." He said, "Great, I've moved to a new publisher. I am starting a new division that's doing wine books, cookbooks, and spirit books, and I want to publish that book." So that's how we wind up doing it. But I mean, as you said, white wine is the drink of choice for many people. And besides that easy drinking white wine, there's a lot of serious, well-made white wine out there as well that, you know, that serious wine drinkers drink too.
Absolutely.
Yes. So you write about 50 grapes and styles. How did you, because there's a huge world of white grapes out there, how did you choose what to include in the book? And also talk about how the book is formatted or the layout design that right. You came up with.
Well, you know, unfortunately, when you work with a publisher, they give you an idea of how much paper they're going to allow when you write a book. So we were, you know, the first book, Red Wine, we chose 50 grapes and, red wine styles. And of course we covered, you know, Merlot, Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, you know, Pinot Noir, all of the top ones. But then some that we found very interesting to ourselves, like Zino Mavro from Greece or
Plavich Mali from Croatia.
Yeah, or Blaufränkisch, you know, from Austria and Germany. So we in our travels, we found some wines that we really, really liked. And we looked at the American market and said, how available are these wines? Because we didn't want to write, you know, if you read the New York Times, and I love the wine writer there, but, you know, sometimes he writes about wines you can only find in one zip code in New York City. And our our friends in Chicago, our friends in, you know, Dallas, they can't find these wines. So we wanted to write a very serviceable book that people can actually use. And the nice thing is they can pick it up, read the chapter on Chardonnay and put it down. And then they can pick it up a week later and read the chapter on Sauvignon Blanc and learn about Sauvignon Blanc and maybe buy a few and then put the book down. It's, you know, you can dip in, dip out. And we chose the 50 grapes, probably the most popular, but then we went a little funky and we picked some grapes that, you know, we really love, like Albariño here in Spain, as you mentioned in the intro. We picked Godello, we picked Verdejo. So, you know, those are wines that we drink every day in Spain. But we also picked Malvasia Itarska from Istria. We picked Assyrtiko from Santorini in Greece. So we picked wines that people can find in their local grocery store or wine shop, but we also picked wines that grapes that we were passionate about. So that's kind of how we picked it. And we rarely fight, but we did fight over those 50 grapes because there were a few that I wanted and there was a few that Mike wanted. So we had a compromise, you know, one for him, one for me, one for him, one for me. So it worked out.
Well, you know, that's one of the things I liked about it. Of course, everyone knows Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc, but there were many white varietals that I had never heard of. And so it was fun learning some, and maybe the rest of the world knows this one, but I didn't. And I'm not even sure I'm going to say it right, though you do give the pronunciations, which I thought is another nice little nugget, but Aux-sur-Bois-Blanc.
Aux-sur-Bois-Blanc.
Yes. That was a new one for me too.
That's from Luxembourg and the Mosel. Well, as you know, there's one river that goes between Germany and Luxembourg, and it's called the Moselle if you're on the French-speaking side, or the Mosel if you're on the German-speaking side. Mm. But on both banks of that river, they do grow Aux-sur-Bois Blanc, and it's a lovely, lovely wine, very crisp, a lot of minerality, so just a stunning, stunning white wine. And what about some others? What did you find fun and exciting?
Well, Mary Orlin, she had some that she, there were a few that Mary said she didn't even realize they were white wine because they appear red in the glass. Mary, which was it?
Yeah. So, I should have known better, but I was like, oh, Marsala and Madeira, they're considered white wines. And I, that was like, oh yeah, I had to think about it for a minute. So that was interesting. Yeah. And
well, they start out as white grapes. So
yeah.
Even though, as you said, they can appear tawny colored or brown or amber colored in the glass, they do start out as white grapes. And as wine, experts yourself, that color comes from aging in the barrel. So Marsala starts out with white grapes, and it's just the longer it sits in that barrel, the darker it gets. But And we went back to the origin of the grape, the color of the grape on the bottle.
Yeah, that was really fun knowledge. Another odd one that I'd never heard of was Poship.
Poship.
Oh, yeah. Poship, yeah. Yes, which is a Croatian grape that grows in Dalmatia and the island of Hvar.
Yeah.
As well. And we actually we're fortunate to have spent a lot of time in Croatia the years.
We were there
2 weeks ago for a wine fair. We're back in Croatia. So we tasted a lot of Malvasia and a lot of Poship while we were there.
That's for sure.
But there were some fun facts. Like, I'm a huge, huge Chenin Blanc fan. And I know it originated in the Loire Valley, but I didn't know that it was named for a Mount Chenin in Loire Valley. So that was kind of fun. And the other thing I didn't know was Gavi. I always thought Gavi was the grape. And no, it's the region, not the grape.
And right. Was the Princess Agave, who the grape is, Gavi de Gavi. Legend that there was a Princess Gavi, and she wanted to marry not the guy her father wanted her to marry. And it became a little bit of a fight. But anyway, he was eventually freed from the jail he put her in. And it's called Gavi.
Yeah, so they named the region.
The region is Gavi, yeah.
Love it.
One of the things I appreciated about the book is that with each varietal, there's little breakout boxes. So it's very user-friendly. So the first breakout box is in the glass. And you talk about the tasting profile, tasting notes, the acidity, body, sweetness. And then there's another little box that'll say, you should know, where you give a little tidbit of information about the wine. And then you also have a breakout box about food pairings. What would this taste great with? And I love that. And then some recommended wines around the world that are made in that style.
Yes. And with the recommended wines, we broke it out into four categories that go from zero to $20. And then we had 20 to 40, 40 to 99. And then we had splurge wines over $100. So there are, our readers were always interested to know that there are some amazing wines that are over white wines that are over $100 a bottle. And there's some stunning, stunning wines.
I think one of the things that shocked me when we were doing it actually is that, and of course, all of the wines that are in there, we received samples and we tasted and we narrowed things down, but there are a couple of very expensive Aligotés from Burgundy. And I actually went back to producers, because Aligoté generally had, French wines in general don't have the grape on the bottle. They have, the appellation. And I had to go back to the producers and say, is this real? Is there really a $435 bottle of wine from Burgundy that's not Chardonnay? And it turned out that was a Thibault Leger Belair wine.
We were with Thibault last week because we were at the auction for Hospice de Nuit Saint-Georges. And the auction for Hospice Nuit Saint-Georges is actually older than the Hospice de Beaune auction, which happens in every November. So we did go to a lovely lunch. We're Chevalier de Tassvin, and we were inducted at the Clos de Vougeot in Burgundy.
And Jeff, what does that mean?
The Chevalier, we're knights of Burgundy.
It's a fraternity, or I guess technically it used to be a brotherhood, although there's an awful lot of women who are members as well.
Right.
And it's an organization that has chapters all over the world of people who are either producers or supporters or lovers of Burgundy. And at Clos de Vougeot in Burgundy, in the small town of Vougeot on the Côte de Nuit, they've got this beautiful old
castle.
winery castle where they have monthly chapter dinners, and all the members it's black tie, and everybody gets to wear their sterling silver task van on their red and yellow ribbon around their neck. They're always fun events. So
we're very honored to be inducted. We were inducted about 10 or 11 years ago now, and it's a beautiful ceremony where they knight you, a king would knight you with a sword on both shoulders, but we were knighted with a 100-year-old grapevine. So it was really cool. So we were at a lunch at Clos de Vougeot just last week, and they poured a glass of
Saturday.
Wine. Saturday. Yeah, so less than a week ago. And they poured a white wine, and I asked, the person pouring, I said, what is this? Is this a Chardonnay? And she was like, no, it's an Aligoté. And it was one of those Aligotés that was like $300 a bottle. And it was amazing. But what's really interesting to me is that the Burgundians are so egocentric and geocentric, where they only grow Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. And anybody that was growing Aligoté, they kind of would add, creme de cassis, a Chambord to it to make a cure. And that's the only thing they ever did with Aligoté. And in the last 10 years, as Mike was saying, we have found some Aligotés that are stunning. And they're not cheap. They're a couple hundred dollars a bottle. But
there are a lot of entry level.
But
entry level in Burgundy now is 35, 40.
Yeah, probably. Right. That's entry level. And Burgundy is expensive. And we drank lovely wine this past week.
So I want the behind the scenes details. So how did you go about researching the book? I think there's like 1500 recommendations of wine in there. Did you guys taste all of these? Have you been to all the regions in the book? What did it take, and how long did it take to put all this together?
Well, yeah, we said you don't really work, but
you don't see us sweat. But to answer your question very simply, the answer is yes and yes. So taste all of the wines that we recommend in the book. Yes. And we probably tasted about 5 or 6 times that number of wine to choose those that we put in the book. And have we been to all of the regions where we're recommending wine? The answer is yes as well. So we've traveled to wine regions. I'm going to say just about every wine region in the world on 5 continents. And we haven't gotten to Antarctica yet because they're not growing wine there. But we certainly will be the first ones when they have an icebreaker that we can go and taste some ice wine when we're down there. But that said, we have traveled extensively around the world, visiting areas, to taste the wines, meet the winemakers, eat the local cuisine. And so we can write about it, not from our desks. One of the things I dislike about a lot of our colleagues is that they get a press release and they write from their desk. We don't do that. We go to the region, learn about the wines, and come back and tell our readers what we found.
That is fabulous. Really fabulous. And what would you say was the most challenging part about putting the book together?
I think it might have been just the amount of time it takes
a lot, yeah.
I mean, just to honestly to sample all the wines and then to and then to sit down and to write everything, and then of course you think, like, you send it off to the publisher and you're like, I'm done with that. And then they send back edits and they've got questions and fact checking and all this kind of stuff. So besides the year it takes to write, there's actually another year after that from the time you turn it in until the time the book actually gets printed, that for about 9 months out of that second year, you're going back and forth with the publisher over things. We also had to organize all the photos as well, which was a whole other thing. So there's, I mean, there's a lot more than just like sitting down and writing the words.
And let me just add that the publishers are very smart, that once you turn the manuscript in, so when you work with a publisher, you get an advance up front, and it's usually 50% of what they're going to pay you for the book. And then you're supposed to get the other 50% when you hand the manuscript in. Unless there's a clause in your contract that says when the manuscript is satisfactory to the publisher. So what that means is you have to, they don't cut that second check to you until you've jumped through all of their hoops. So as Mike said, you know, you turn the book in and you're like, whoo, I'm done. And then for 9 months, you have to do this little dance with, no, I don't want a comma there. I want a semicolon. I want this, you know, and it's really, it's an arduous process. But once you get that book in your hands and you say, oh my God, we created this book, it really is a great, great moment. And Wood, the book is selling so well. You know, we're talking to the publisher about doing, you know, reprints once we sell out the initial print run. And I think we're pretty close. So things are really good. So we're very happy. I know our publisher has submitted the book to a couple of competitions coming up. So maybe the next time we come back on your show, I'd love to be able to tell you we won an award, but I don't want to jinx it because we don't know.
We will keep our fingers crossed for sure. I wanted to ask, what were some of the fun discoveries that you made in writing this book? Were there any fun adventures that happened along the way that were memorable?
Well, one of the things that was fun that we discovered, which we didn't realize, is that there are more regional white blend styles than red. So for example, we talked about like agave and suave and Madeira, you know, which are types of wine that are made with more than one type of grape, and they're known by the region, not the, you know, not just the individual variety. And it was, you know, it's kind of cool to know. I think that there's 34 single varieties and 16 blend styles, which is like, I think there's only maybe 9 or 10 blend styles in red wine. So that was, I mean, that was really interesting. And then again, just in terms of going to like real, like just really cool places, like going to Luxembourg and discovering Auxerrois Blanc, going to the island of Madeira and seeing how Madeira is made. Cause like, unlike every other type of wine in the world, where the goal is to keep the, you know, to keep the barrels as cool as possible during the maturation phase, in Madeira, they, you know, the wine is actually not kept in cellars or caves, but in attics. You go upstairs and there's windows and they want it to be hot for the evaporation. Mm-hmm. You get that beautiful oxidized quality. And so part of it was, I mean, besides like, you know, like writing the words and putting ideas to life, there was a lot of pieces of really cool wine travel where there's, you know, there's always something to learn. Even for us, there's always something to learn. And you're, and like, it's like, wow, this, like, this is cool. There's still something really cool in the world out there.
Right. You also wrote about these little fishing huts. Trying to remember. The Trabocchi. So you have some like little offbeat travel tips for people. If you're reading this and you're studying, you know, about the grapes in the region you're going to go visit. I love these little tips.
Well, thanks.
Thank you.
The Trabocchi are really cool, by the way. They look like spiders, like over the water, because they were used to have fishing nets attached between the arms, but they're not really used anymore. So you go to them, and there's a few of them in our, you know, where we were staying, the concierge said, go to this one. This one's the best. And you walk in and, you know, we speak enough Italian to know what we're getting into, but there's no menu and no prices, and you just order and you just hope for the best when the bill comes. And I think it was probably about seven courses with seven different wines. And I think the bill was under $100 for the two of us.
Oh, so, wow.
Yeah. So it was really, really cool. And that's a great discovery. I definitely recommend.
I also, one quick thing, I'd love that you pointed out that Frank Sinatra loves Suave. And
yes.
I live in Palm Springs. And so I'm thinking that's a great little tip for me here. And I think that should become, you know, Suave should become the white wine of Palm Springs because of that.
There you go. Well, you know, Suave, it was one of Frank's favorite wines. And we were told that by the producer of Suave. And we did some, the people from Suave Bola. Yeah. And so we did a little bit of research into that. And we found out that, yes, it was true that, you know, Sammy Davis Jr., you know, might have a martini in his glass. Somebody else might have a scotch, you know, Dean Martin. But Frank was drinking Suave for the most part. He was a white wine drinker.
Isn't that interesting? See, fun little nuggets. I love that. And the book is chock full of nuggets like that. And it's, as you said, the book, a kind of a book that you can pick up, put down, and it is timeless in that sense. And the fact that white wine is growing in popularity makes the timing of this book really good. I wanted to ask you guys, why do you think white wine's becoming more popular? We see more people drinking it and sales are up, but what do you think's behind that?
You know, I think actually in general, you know, like we're all eating a little bit lighter food than we used to. I think everyone, I mean, I like we're, you know, we're carnivores, but I think that we eat more chicken than we used to
and fish
and we eat more salads and everything. So I think white wine just lends itself to a lighter style of eating. It's also lower in alcohol. It's very refreshing too. It's more, you know, red, and there's plenty of easy drinking red wines. But I just think in general, people who live in warm weather areas or people who are drinking outside, whether it's on the deck or by the pool or at their country club or whatever during the summer, in hot weather, a red wine that, you know, the tannins can just be too much and they can be overpowering. So white wine is really the choice for lighter foods and warmer weather eating or drinking.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you.
Mary Orland said that bubbly is another driver of the white wine craze.
Right.
People are drinking more champagne and other sparkling wines and not just saving them for anniversaries or graduations.
Yeah, I think finally, the message that all of us who write about wine and talk about wine have been putting out for years, like, don't just save bubbles for special occasions. People do drink sparkling wine all the time. And that's, you know, and that's part of the, you know, one of the reasons that champagne is so popular. Prosecco is so popular. Cava is all, actually, I was surprised to learn, you know, working on another project that Cava is the most popular style of Spanish wine drunk in the United States. Cava accounts for almost 30%, like 29% of all the Spanish wine drunk in the US is Cava. And then Rioja kind of trails right behind it at 25%.
Wow. So Mike and Jeff, with all this popularity around white wine now, what do you think it's going to take for us to get a white wine emoji?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know, that's something that I don't comprehend why. I mean, who runs the emojis, you know? I don't comprehend why we don't have one yet. I just kind of use the, you know, the sparkling wine, the two glasses clinking as my white wine emoji, and you know what I'm talking about.
Exactly. I do absolutely. So also, there is a National White Wine Day. It happens to be August 4th. Do you guys do anything special on White Wine Day?
Well, I think just like every other day, we drink some wine.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we do August 4th. It is a national holiday, and we do like to drink white wine. So maybe we'll have an extra bottle, you know, and share with some friends and have some nice white wine. But basically, you know, we choose the wine that we're going to drink based on the wines that we taste, you know, for the various publications. or for, you know, our books or whatever. And we'll taste a bunch of wines and we'll pull one or two that we think are really exceptional out of tasting 30 wines. And those are the two wines we'll have with dinner. We'll usually have a white wine with a lighter course, you know, a fish course or a salad. And then we'll have a red wine with, you know, a meat course. So yes, we'll celebrate that holiday, but we are not exempt from celebrating National Tempranillo Day, National Malbec Day, or any of those red wine
holidays. National Drink Wine
Day. National Drink Wine Day, yes.
We are equal opportunity celebrators.
Right,
as well.
But I will say that we do believe that people should drink in moderation, enjoy wine, but enjoy your family and friends and drink in moderation because, you know, doctors have said that wine is good for your health, but it is kind of in moderation. So we do practice that.
A nice reminder, and so true, that all of the great things about wine can be undone by overdoing it. And yes, we've all suffered the headaches because of it.
Oh, yes. Yes. And you only have to get a little older to realize that you don't want that headache the next day.
And the missed sleep.
Yes. Exactly.
So tell me about life in Spain. When did you mention when you guys moved to Costa del Sol?
Yeah, you know, we bought the house 20 years ago, and it didn't start out as we always joke, it wasn't a serious pursuit. I have this terrible habit of looking in real estate office windows when we're out, when we're traveling and we're out and about. And, you know, and kind of be like, oh, look, we could, you know, look at this place, look at that place. But we came to the Costa del Sol on vacation probably 22, 23 years ago, and really fell in love with it. It ticked off all the boxes. We love the architecture. We love the style of life. We love the food. We're both beach people. And at that time just said, you know, this would be the place if we were going to retire anywhere, this is going to be it. And so we bought the house 20 years ago. And, you know, we're moving, writing. And now that the world's moved to working remotely, we go back and forth a lot. We spend, you know, a good chunk of time in New York, but we spend a lot of time here in Spain as well.
Absolutely. And it's nice to be here.
The photos I've seen of it sure look beautiful. The architecture, you know, the beaches. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it is gorgeous. We're really, really lucky. So yeah, all good things. We can't complain.
So what's next after the white wine book?
Rest and relaxation.
We actually do a lot of magazine work.
Yes.
You know, we're the wine editors at Rob Report. Right. And that keeps us really busy, and it's super fulfilling.
I have to say that I love the article you did about it was entitled "Forget Sideways: Why It's Time to Drink Some Effing Merlot Again." I thought that was awesome.
Exactly. Thank you.
Well,
thank you.
We write a weekly newsletter for Rob Report, and then we also write a weekly through story and then a roundup. So we're writing a lot for Rob Report. We're very honored to be their wine editors, and really enjoying, you know, writing for digital, but also one article every month for the print magazine. So we're having a really good time, and we do get to write fun articles like "It's time to start drinking effing Merlot." So, so it's great. We get, you know, our editor is very cool and gives us that freedom, and, you know, trusts our expertise, which is really very, very nice.
Dare I ask, if you're not drinking wine, what's your next go-to beverage?
Water.
Sparkling water and and then coffee and tea.
Coffee,
tea in the morning, coffee in the afternoon.
And lots of sparkling water and wine. But I will say that I'm good for about one or two gin and tonics a year. Mm-hmm. So I like gin and tonics, but, you know, the high alcohol just goes right to my head. Wine is
a little gentler.
A little gentler. And it's nice to sit on the beach and drink a glass of wine. So as we're going to do in a few minutes, we're going out for wine and tapas. We're going to meet some friends here in Spain.
Oh, perfect. Well, we won't keep you. I just one last question. Do you guys feel that you have the same sense of your palates are similar? Do you have similar things that you taste in wine, or not?
I would say yes. I would say yeah, we do. I mean, sometimes we're in alignment and agreement most of the time.
But let me say this. We, you know, when you say that we're getting the same notes, yes, we both smell black cherry. We can both smell cassis. We can both smell leather. But then the question is, you know, when we're rating wines professionally, it doesn't matter if we like it or don't like it. It's whether it's a well-made wine, and this is a wine that can age. You know, you have to think of all these things before you give a point. So we agree on the profile, the aroma, the taste, but we don't always agree whether we like it or not. But when we come down to being professional and scoring it professionally, we're generally right on the same score with the same flavor profile. So the answer is yes, but then we have different likes and dislikes. So that's what makes it interesting.
And do you have a favorite white wine or white grape variety?
I have a new one. And I have a new one. We were just in the Penedès region last week, and there's a grape called Xarello. Xarello, which is one of the three grapes that goes into cava.
Oh, right.
And a lot of producers there are making still versions. There's not a lot in the States, but they're starting to be there. But we actually drank a lot of Xarello in a few days. And it's like a new toy for us.
Yeah. And to answer that question, my favorite wine that I'm drinking right now is the one that's going to be in my glass. So or the wine that's in my glass, but I don't have a wine in my glass yet. So I have to wait.
The one you're drinking with your good friends.
That's right. Exactly. That's my favorite wine.
Nice. Well, we know tapas and wine awaits, so we should let you go. But this has been so fun getting to know you guys, Mike and Jeff, and just love the new book, White Wine, the Comprehensive Guide to the 50 Essential Varieties and Styles. It is a beautiful book to put out on a coffee table. It is also a great book to pick up and read. It's just chock full of knowledge and very approachable.
Absolutely. And it's the type of book that, you know, you're going to go back to over and over again, depending on which white wine you're drinking at the time.
Yes, right. And some great suggestions of things, new stuff to try, which I need because I tend to get in a rut of the things I like, I go back to over and over again.
Well, you definitely need to be in touch and let us know that we've pulled you out of your comfort zone and you're trying some new wines. So definitely let us know when that happens.
Will do. And thank you again for joining us. We really enjoyed the conversation, and sip, sip, hooray to both of you.
Yes, cheers and sip, sip, hooray, guys.
Cheers.
Cheers to
sip,
you.
Sip, hooray.
Cheers.
Well, Mary Babbitt, I am so thirsty for a glass of white wine right now.
Me too.
And I'm just going to turn to this book to see what I should drink next and go out and get it.
Right. It really does have a lot of great suggestions. And as the guys mentioned, at different price points. So you're not only going to find, you know, ultra expensive, fancy white wines, but there's some bargains in here too. Mm-hmm. Regularly, each page includes bargains. So right. That speaks to me as well.
I love that. And we will be posting information about the World Wine Guys on our show notes at our website, sipsipparepodcast.com.
That's right. And you can also find us on social media. We are on Instagram and Facebook. And we encourage you to like, share, and let your friends know about Sip Sip Hooray, the podcast.
Right. And whatever platform you listen to us on, we'd love it if you'd leave us a review, give us a rating. It helps others find the podcast. And we have a Substack that you can go to. And there's two ways to subscribe to our podcast on our Substack, which is under Sip Sip Hooray Podcast. But also you can subscribe on whatever platform you're listening to, especially if you're on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify, and that way you'll get notified when we drop a new episode, which we don't want you to miss anything.
Not a minute of it. So thank you so much for listening. We appreciate you. And do let us know what you'd like to hear on Sip Sip Hooray.
All right, Mary Babbitt. Well, let's go get a glass of white wine.
Sounds good. Cheers to you, Mary Orland.
Cheers. Sip, sip, hooray.